June 15, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for HBSDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been working on adding some more videos to the website. George Brickett has put up a series of videos from the HamSci meeting in March in Cleveland on his website, his YouTube site, and so I made links to those in tangerinesdr.com. So I made those links available. I did not add those to the OpenHPSDR site as they were less relevant to the kinds of work we're doing, although OpenHPSDR was mentioned in some of the talks. So that was my week. And next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, all. I spent the week doing various things, but a lot of time kind of reading between the lines on the NVIDIA sites about the NVIDIA Nano. Finally, the documentation has dropped for the modules, and also a lot of other interesting things. So I've been looking at that. I've been doing some coding, mostly in JavaScript. I should be doing some in C, I think, but nothing of great import to anybody but me, I suppose.
Well, fine business, Dave. And next on the list, we have Greg ZL3IX, shown as mic muted. And then we have Henry PA0HJA, shown recording and away. And then we have Mike AA8K, shown as recording and mic muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to TeamSpeak. archives.openhpsdr.org. Next, we have Phil, VK6PH. Go ahead, Phil.
Thanks, Dave. Ooh, not much to report this week, mainly dealing with emails for some of our users who had some questions relating to Pure Signal and a couple of other digital signal processing questions. Full week this week, so that's got done. Not much news from down under at the moment. Back to you, Dave.
Fine business. And next on the list is Bill, KD5TFD. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dave, nothing really to report here. Sort of buried with work. I thought it was bad before we launched. It's much worse after. Back to you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Next on the list, we have Bob, VE3JKM, shown as recording in a way. And that brings us to the end of the list. I did want to make a mention that I am a regular user of Lin HPSDR by John Melton, and there have been a lot of updates and improvements to his Lin HPSDR software. So if you use that, I would highly recommend recompiling your code and updating it, because John has done a lot of work, so it's well worth it. So that brings us to the end of the list, so we're open for general discussion. Dave, I had a question for you. Is there a location where some of the changes for the NVIDIA Nano are documented or listed?
I can post a link to the documentation downloads page. You may have to create an account. They don't charge you anything or do anything to you, but you may have to make a link in order to download it. But I can post the link here or put it through on here. There's lots of documentation, much to look at. It doesn't look like it wants to let me paste a message. Not sure if I was doing the right thing.
It worked that time, Dave.
Yeah, it was talking about server messages versus chat messages. I don't know. I don't understand. But I switched.
Oh, you have to be on the OpenHPSDR tab, not the OpenHPSDR TeamSpeak server tab.
I see. These things are kind of lost on me. I don't understand all this that well.
Well, I think that's common with many of the users.
Here's another link that just lists a quick posting of some of the changes for anyone who might be interested in using these modules. Now it's looking like they're not going to make them available until the 1st of August, but they're comparable overall to the original TK1s, I would say. And they the module exposes four lanes of PCIe at 2.0 gigabit Ethernet and USB 3. So there's plenty of ways to get data in and out of the thing. And it operates at rates I think should be very suitable for a lot of radio type signal processing, even though that's not what they were really meant for. They've also lowered the price on some of the earlier models.
Well, the one that pops out to me is the Jetson TX2 4 gigabyte at $250.
Yeah, that has less memory than the earlier ones. It's only 4 gig instead of, I think, 8. But since we're not doing, we're not building AI applications here, we're doing signal processing, 4 gigs I would think would be quite a bit.
That puts it very close to what we paid for the TK1s.
Yeah, or the Nanos, which will be, I think, $129 for the bare module. There's so many options, it's hard to know what to do.
Yep, and I guess it's time to brush up on GPU program. Hello, Scotty, how are you?
Hey there, Dave, how's it going? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. We've done the initial roll call, and we've been talking about a few changes in the Nano boards have put out their future specs, and then John Melton's been making some updates to his Lin HPSDRs. So that's about mostly what we've talked about.
Okay, you said Nano boards. Is that some new single board computers?
Yeah, the NVIDIA single board computers, up till now, the ones that have been released are missing some components. And Dave Whitten here has mentioned that more documentation is available on the future model, and all the development ones are being discounted, so you can buy them cheaper.
Oh, okay. So are the production ones out yet, or are imminent?
Well, Dave says they're should be available in 1st of August.
They've, at least they're posting that now, as of late this afternoon, that they'll be available in August. I don't know if that's just a head off. That may be when they'll be in the distributor's hands. But at least the module spec is fully out there. And the final modules, they're only different in that they have an eMMC memory module on them, a 16 gig. But they've worked out the last of the specifications.
Okay, and that module's on the baseboard, right? Not on the plug-in module.
No, these are plug-in. The baseboard is just a baseboard, nothing. Just has the Ethernet and what all.
Oh, okay. So could I take the production plug-in module and plug it into my existing baseboard and get an eMMC port on it?
I believe so. I don't think they're changing the baseboard at all.
Okay, so that's interesting. So the module is going to actually snap onto the plug-in, the eMMC module, a little bitty postage stamp guy. He's going to plug onto the plug-in module that then goes into the baseboard.
No, maybe we're not using quite the same terminology. The what NVIDIA calls the module board is the one with the 260-pin sodium edge connector. The baseboard being the developer kit itself, which is what has all the accessories broken out, or some of them. And the eMMC will be soldered on the production module boards, and they'll be about $129 a piece, I believe. The current modules just have that eMMC spot empty.
Oh, okay. So it's probably not even going to be a different artwork board. It's just going to be populated differently.
Yeah, and I think they had some internal configuration, you know, who knows, some things that they've been able to work out about who gets put where.
Yeah, so probably not just, it's not simple as just soldering the module down, But yeah, I know what you mean. So the module to me is the thing with the gold fingers that plugs into the 200 and whatever pin socket, the memory socket. And then the baseboard has all of the Ethernet connector and USB connectors and all that stuff on it, right?
Yeah, I think we're using the same terminology now.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. It'd be on the plug-in module because it's got to be coupled pretty tightly.
I've seen it both ways, but it sure makes a lot more sense to do that.
So do they say how big it is going to be, like 8 gig or 16 gig?
I think it's a 16 gig eMMC that they're putting on it, as I recall.
Yeah, so do you know if it's SATA, SATA 2 or 3 or PCI Express?
For the eMMC, I don't know how that's done.
Okay, or maybe I'm confused. The M.2 connector, the NGFF, those boards, I think they're called NVMEs, and the eMMC is different. I think I got that right.
Yeah, I think you're right. The eMMC memory, it may not be different memory than what's on the NVMe plug-in modules for memory sticks or for laptops and things, but this is not doing an M.2 connector. The only M.2 connector on there is one really for Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I think you said it was soldered on, so that makes it unlike our things that are supposed to be our M.2 connectors are going to be used for all kind of different options. And I know this belongs on the other TeamSpeak session, but Dave, I've got the preliminary drawings done for the low-speed I/O board, the expansion board, and so I'll send them. I'm going to put them on a document and post them up to the other list and see if it makes sense.
Oh, very good. I'll check that. I did get George's videos all linked up, so those have been done this week.
Yeah, there's been a discussion on the board list about where the videos should be and all that, and I'm kind of like ambivalent about where they are as they're linked.
Well, somebody who runs the Tapper website needs to create a video HTML and make more links because they seem to be stored in lots of different places.
Yeah, well, now you know the reason why I wanted to have the Tangerine SDR website and not have it on the Tapper website.
Yeah, well, I know how it's just like any of it. A group of volunteers, things move at different rates.
Well, I think part of the problem is the Tapper website. I mean, it has all the storefront, it has all the history, it has there's a ton of information there, and it was designed a long time ago, and it's difficult to modify and add new things, so it tends to not get done then.
Yeah, I understand.
But anyway, apparently Mark has created a YouTube channel for Tapper, but George asked him for the credentials so he could post stuff there, and Mark never got back to him. So George, being the aggressive, I'm going to get it done guy that he is, just created his own channel and put the videos up.
Yeah, and that's what he told me to do. He said, well, you can go and make a YouTube account, and that's what I did for the videos that I created.
Yeah, and I'm good with that. I just, you know, at some point, it's good to have them all in one place, because when you or I get run over by a truck and accounts eventually go away, then we'd kind of like to have the videos stay.
Well, I have copies of all the MP4s that I've ever dealt with and all the ones that are linked on the OpenHPSDR site, except for this last round, we have copies of all those back to 2008. So if somebody ever wants a data dump, we can do it.
Yeah, in case our ISP loses everything.
Well, I have copies on my own machine.
Well, I guess it's not our ISP, it's YouTube, right, that has the copies.
YouTube has copies of this recent stuff, but it was only 2019 that the YouTube has been used at all.
Oh, okay. So where did you put videos before that? Up on the other site, the other HPSDR, the other SDR site?
I put it on the OpenHPSDR site in just a directory, and we have such low volume that it hasn't alerted the ISP provider.
Yeah, so would that be a problem if we put videos up there and suddenly we got, you know, hundreds of viewers every day watching the videos? Would we be in trouble?
I don't know. It kind of depends on the service provider, and so far the one we use for OpenHPSDR has not complained that I know of. Bill, have they complained?
Yeah, I guess when you sign up, you get a certain amount of bandwidth. It depends on how much of it you use, I guess. This seems like it's 3,000 gigabytes, maybe. It's like three terabytes. Does that sound right?
Something like that. Go ahead, Bill.
There's no way we have terabytes of bandwidth. We have quote-unquote unlimited, but I suspect if you stretch that, you will hear from them, or they will just stop serving you. But yeah, I haven't gotten any from them. What are we hosting, or?
Well, the old videos from different Tapper talks at Dayton and DCC and Friedrichshafen have been put on our video directory, and they're sitting there, and people can click on them and view them. But we only get about 1,200 hits to OpenHPSDR a month at the current time. At least that's what the analytics say.
Yeah, no, I have no problem putting stuff there. I would like to see stuff there. I'd like to see stuff at least minimally archived at places that we control, lest somebody that we don't control manages to lose it, flush it, or just decide to get uninterested in the business, and we end up losing a ton of data or, you know, history.
Or something happens to them. I mean, we all know we all expire sooner or later.
Yep. Or turn into a cat site.
Oh, no.
Have you ever looked at hpsdr.org? It's now a Japanese cat site.
Oh, really?
Let's not go there.
Don't have videos and things?
I don't know. I just clicked on it every once in a while. But anyway, we do have lots. I have copies of all the videos that I've had anything to do with. We don't have copies of all of Gary's or the other guy's videos downloaded. So I don't know how to go about making an archive of those.
Yeah, and I think for the most part anyway, the slides and the presentations are on the Tapper website, but no videos. So on another subject, I'd like to maybe try and get started on porting the programmer to the IQ2, if you have time to work a little bit on that.
There is some possibility. What would be nice is getting, there's a fellow that produced, well, Phil knows him, Rick, who produced a bunch of RBFs for the different versions of of OpenHPSDR, and he seems, if you could provide the pinouts for the FPGA, I think he could do it fairly efficiently. Do you know, Phil, if Rick has access to do that kind of work?
Now, Rick's got access to all the source code, yeah. In fact, I think the source code that's currently published is Rick's.
I think the only real difference then, Scotty, is you're using a Cyclone 5 and you're using different pinouts for the FPGA than the standard for Anon 7000 or whatever would be the appropriate equivalent board.
Right. Well, the thing is that we're using a QSPI flash, so it's 4 bits wide, so the programming of it is different than the serial ones, the single bit one.
Well, the that part would be my mind to work on, so for the programmer. But what I'm curious about is, would our bootloader work on, if we have to put the bootloader source into the FPGA, but would it still work with yours?
Right. Well, the thing is that I want to use a different protocol to do the programming, slightly different, and maybe it's very much the same, but it's slightly different. And so I'm not really concerned about the radio operating firmware at this point. I'm concerned about getting the programmer portion working so that we can slip in upgrades really fast. And I mean, even if the payload of the programmer is a Hello World flashing LED, that, you know, at least because I know what's going to happen is we're going to have bootloader code, and it's probably going to be different than the bootloader code for Hermes, because the protocol is going to be slightly different, and then your end will have to be tweaked some too.
Well, I have the hardware, and I have it running with your protocol 1 code right now, and so I guess what I need is more a place where I can read about the definition of what I need to know to address the flash.
Yeah, okay. So you basically need to know how to talk to the bootloader code that I have to put in the FPGA, because it actually is going to talk to the flash, so it'll do the programming, but you'll have to command it.
Yes, yes. And so what I need from you is that information. And I'm in the process of, I have a working Protocol 2 program. I have not ever gotten clean dual protocol programmer, but I'm starting to wonder if that's the best solution for me. But I do need to make one that runs a little more efficiently for the OpenHPSDR programmer.
Well, so the GUI that I have in mind that we've talked about a little bit before, could you make that so that it talked to different modules for the different protocols, so that it would basically look the same to the user, even though it would use all three protocols? By three, I mean Protocol 1, Protocol 2, and the LCC protocol that we're working on now.
Well, the difference is how you organize the packets and send them, but also if you're trying to discover them on the, so they're plugged into the network and you're trying to find them to get the address of what that you're going to write to.
Right, so the discovery is a little bit different, but you still send 256 byte packets, right?
Yes, and then you just, the programmer takes what needs to go up there, divides it into packets, puts a checksum on it, and then processes it, sends it on, and then we're doing a reply on every packet so that you know that it actually got there and was correct.
Okay, so every packet is numbered, sequence numbered, because I've seen that, and then does every packet, it has the total number of packets in the programming sequence, and so when you get the packet, you check the checksum. If it checks good, then you ACK it, and then you wait for the next one. And if the originator in the PC doesn't get an ACK back, then it's just aborts, right? Because it's broken. There's no retries, it just aborts.
Yeah. It does, if you get a no acknowledgement ACK, it will try to resend the new one. But I don't know how many resends. That's some of the code that Rick was working.
Okay, but if it gets no answer back, then what happens?
Then it would abort, and you'd have to go back. Generally, if the programmer fails at that point, it's time to use the bootloader to put the receiving device back into the FPGA.
So that means each 256-byte packet you get, then, when you get it and you verify the checksum, you actually program that sector of the flash with that 256 bytes?
Well, it's written into the flash.
Right, but it's written into the flash piece by piece, not, you don't wait till you get all of it before you write it in, because you think you have that enough memory to do that.
No, we don't.
Okay, so that means if you get three or four packets and then for some reason it aborts, now your image is corrupted and you have to go back to the default booter, right?
Right, right. And so we can go through all of that, and there's a possibility we could write a common one, or at least a common procedural version, but then change the protocol between the two.
So do you have any documentation on how the loader works other than what's in your code?
Yes, but also I depend on just bits and pieces of code that I got from either John Milton or Phil or Rick.
Okay, something that I could read to get my head around actually what happens, because I want to write the code for the LCC that goes in the FPGA, and so I'm kind of on the other end of the wire there.
Well, we got Phil here who wrote the other end of the wire for the HPSDR.
Okay, so Phil, can you give me the 2-minute synopsis of how it works for programming the FPGA?
In the bootloader mode or the standard mode?
In the standard mode.
It uses regular IP connection. So the first thing you do is do a discovery. You can then check the IP address and the MAC address, which is what I normally do, to check that you're connected to the right device. You then have to pad. You read read the file, split it into the read the file you want to program is into 256 bytes, and it's not there's no guarantee that it's going to be there will be n slices of 256 bytes, which the last byte is exactly 26. So you have to pad it with I think we pad it with FFs. You then this is done on the n 256 byte packets. You then send it with particular settings, so that there's a particular setting you have to send that tells the FPGA code that this is in, you're in programmer mode, and that's documented in the USB. It's called USB protocol for protocol 1 and Ethernet protocol for protocol 2, which defines what the packet looks like, what the headers and the tailors are, tailies, etc. And that's sent over to the FPGA. As Dave says, the sequence number's checked, and subsequently, which I haven't actually looked at that code because Rick did it, there's a CRC added to the end of the packet. If the packet's received okay, it is immediately put into the flash because, as you said, we don't have enough memory to do it. And that continues until the number of packets you've said are going to be sent are received, in which case the FPGA code ceases, hits the reset on the FPGA so you don't have to do power cycle the board, and away you go. You're now running the new code.
Okay, and then in the case where a checksum is bad, then you send a NAC back, right? You send a non-acknowledged back to tell it that packet, that particular 256 byte block was bad?
I'm not sure, to be honest, Scotty. Rick added that feature to the FPGA code and recently, and I haven't actually looked at the code, but certainly that, you know, that that code is in the public domain. It's on GitHub, so if you want to have a look through it, you'd see exactly what's being done.
Okay, very good. Because I remember we had some problems, bricking the main firmware, and then you end up having to go back and use the backup loader to retry it again. And was that because you didn't have checksum, or you didn't do a retry? What was the fix that fixed that problem?
The checksum.
Okay, so what you were doing is then you were getting a bad block, and you were programming it in, and then it broke things, right?
Yeah, as far as you could tell, programming had been okay. You received all the packets you needed, but when you actually ran the when it rebooted and ran the firmware, the firmware didn't run. The risk was that where the error had occurred was in the programming code in the FPGA, so you couldn't reprogram it, in which case you had to go into bootloader.
Right, right. You get a corrupted image, and then it doesn't work right at all. So you have to go back and put the jumper on and load the known good side. If I remember right, there were two images in the ROM, right? And one started at the bottom and counted up, and the other started at the top and counted down. Is that right?
There's two images in the ROM. One was at address start address 0, which is the bootloader, and the second one is the actual image. So that when the FPGA starts, it runs the bootloader code, and the first thing the bootloader code does is to check an I/O pin, and depending whether the I/O pin's high or low, it either stays in bootloader mode or it starts loading from, I think, address at 1 meg, which is where the regular code is, the conventional code is stored.
That agrees with my impression.
Okay, so but the idea is you can't do a partial load. So what you do then is when you power up, the first thing you do is load the bootloader code by itself, and that's all it does is bootloader code, which then looks at the jumper. And then if that jumper is not set, then you basically do a reset, but start loading at 1 meg and up, and you get the operational code then, right?
Exactly right. Yeah, the bootloader code, power up the FPGA, the bootloader code always runs, and it decides where it's going to start loading code from.
And then the main operational bootloader is actually part of the image, right? So it's ready to accept programming commands once it's up and running.
That's correct, yeah.
So, Scotty, I've given you two links below. The one on the Tapper site is the official Protocol 2 documentation, which has what Phil has been describing. And then the second one is Rick's site, and it has an OpenHPS SDR programmer, Protocol 2 programmer, and a OpenHPS SDR firmware that incorporate all the CRC.
Okay, yeah, so the Protocol 2 documents I have, those are the same ones that that Phil has sent to me.
The second site has the things that have the CRC change. We in the first the one that's on the Tapper site, we have updated to count packets. That was the first thing we tried, and they decided finally to go ahead and put a CRC in there. And when we put the CRC in, it was Rick that actually did both the CRC firmware and the CRC into the programmer code that I had written. It was really only a matter of maybe 50 lines of code in the program.
That was to add the CRC, you mean?
Yeah, yes. And Rick is the one that I think can help us with getting a version of your IQ2 with protocol 2.
Okay, I'm looking at the protocol document. Okay, so in the program packet, you have the sequence number, the command, which is 5, and the number of blocks, and then the 256 bytes. And I don't see a checksum. This is the version 3.8.
At this point, I think he probably didn't upgrade the documentation, but he has upgraded the code, new OpenHPSDR directory.
Okay, so there's a sequence number and a command and the number of blocks and a checksum and then the data.
Yes.
Or maybe the data and then the checksum.
The second version is what we have. I've spent some time on it, and then I got sidetracked by work. And so I haven't gotten back to it, and hopefully this summer I'll be able to work on it.
Okay, yeah, so it'd be nice to have working on all three protocols.
Yes.
So, Phil, here's a quick question for you. I noticed on a lot of the command things like the discovery packet and an erase packet and things like that, it's byte-filled out to 60 bytes. Is there some reason for that?
Yeah, there's a minimum packet length or UDP packet.
Oh, there is. So it has to be 60 bytes of payload plus whatever the header is?
No, it has to be. Yeah, you've got to have 60 bytes of payload. The maximum, I think, we're not using jumbo frames. So I think the maximum's about 1,500 from memory. But you've got to send at least 60 in the payload.
Yes, I think it's 1,500 is the total size, including the headers. So you get like 1,441 or something.
Yeah, we're using jumbo packets on the DFC code. But for the regular P2 code, it's just the standard. I think you're right, 1,500, including the headers, yeah.
So do you have any trouble with using jumbo packets as far as routing them or moving them across the wire?
No, not at all. I think I'd send 81920 on either 2 to the N packet length. I think the maximum's 9K, I think, from memory. So I'm sending about 8K, and absolutely no problem at all.
Did that work? Excuse me. Did that work from your house up to John?
No, it didn't. Did it? No, it wouldn't work, Dave. The speed would be way too much. Only locally across my network.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, Scotty. Is it just within the network, local network?
Well, I know I have some other SDRs that use jumbo frames. We had difficulty in that some switches didn't handle jumbo frames, but this was years ago, so that those may have been fixed by now.
Yeah, certainly the switch I've got, a ProSafe switch, and that handles jumbo packets, no problem at all.
Okay, very good. Well, I'm going to read up on all these, on the protocol and all that. probably would be a good idea if doing the programmer with the checksum, we probably ought to get that put in somewhere.
Well, it is in the, it's still in beta on the protocol 2, but the newest versions are both checksummed. And we always can use, at least with HPSDR, we can always use the old John Melton's bootloader code to put the first version in. So it's only for people who already have that loaded and then want to update it.
So even protocol 1, your programmer uses checksum then, right?
No, it doesn't. Just writes it.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And if it doesn't work, you run it again.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
And a lot of people would get frustrated with that because, ultimately, if you mess up the bootloader, you have to go back and put the bootloader in with Cortex. But, basically the thing is you just try it a number of times and eventually it'll work.
Well, with protocol 1 or 2, you never overwrite the bootloader, right? You're always writing at 1 meg and above for the main image.
Only the people Only
yeah, that's right, Scotty. In fact, in the programmer code, there's a check that just in case something goes wrong, that you actually can't write in the bottom 1 meg of the EEPROM.
So the big deal here is the only way you can, as a user, mess it up is to reprogram the EEPROM from Cortex.
Right. So in other words, right into the bottom 1 meg, which your programmer won't allow, but Cortex, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that sometimes happens. You know, someone will have a USB blaster and plug it in and just program the IBF file directly into the FPGA, in which case they've overwritten the the bootloader. Then they try and load new code later on. Of course, it loads it up into the top meg, but there's no way of running that new code. But I don't want to keep my fingers crossed, but I'm not aware of the bootloader code being damaged. I use it virtually all the time now because I'm never sure whether the actual main code's going to run properly or not. So I generally use the bootloader all the time. But I found it to be very, very reliable. And because I'm mainly writing development code, that's how I generally load all my code using John's original bootloader.
And well, I do the same.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you load a damaged image, the hardware in the FPGA won't load that. So you won't get anything to run. But if you protect the bottom meg, then I think what happens is they fire up Cortex and they erase the entire flash, and then they load the top meg, and then the bootloader at the bottom is gone, and so they have no way to do anything. They damage the upper boot.
Well, what happens is if you raise the FPGA, then you'll load the P1, so code in the double EEPROM at address 0. So when you boot, it'll run from there, and the code will run fine, assuming it's, you know, no problems with it. Then if you use that code to download a new RBF file, the programmer will load it at a meg, which case, because there's no bootloader, when you restart the FPGA, it'll run the old code, not the new code.
Right, because the old code doesn't have the bootloader that automatically jumps and reloads the code at a meg. It just loads its code starting at 0.
That's correct, yeah.
So out of curiosity, how do you get the bootloader how do you reset the... I know there's a pin on the FPGA, an output pin that goes to the reprogram input of the FPGA, so you can essentially trigger a reload. How do you get it to start at a meg and not 0?
No, it does start. It always runs, when you restart the FPGA, it always runs from address 0, which is the bootloader. And depending whether there's a jumper set or not, the bootloader decides where it continues to load from, either from the low part of the memory to run the bootloader or a meg and above.
Okay, but that means that the bootloader code at 0 is a complete FPGA image that gets loaded and then starts executing, and then it looks at the jumper, and then somehow it continues the loading above a meg. And how does it do that?
There is a function that Cortex provides, which enables you to do that.
Okay, so I presume that you place the flash programmer block in Cortex, and it provides all the hooks into programming the flash, and part of that is setting the address and doing programming?
Yeah, there's it's a long, long time ago since, but there's a library you can call which is set up to do that, to decide where you boot from. You can have two images of FPGA, and you can decide, you always start the first thing, you decide where you boot from there, and it's a standard function within Cortex, and it's been around for years and years.
Scotty, I left you a link, the last link here, the Protocol One programmer. It's the actual code, the C code of the HPSDR bootloader, and if you read through it, you'll find where they're calling that special function.
Okay, but this is the C code that you wrote that runs on the PC, right?
It's C code that John Melton and I maintain.
Oh, this is John's bootloader. Okay, the one Phil was talking about.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's all publicly available and mostly on the Tapper website.
Okay, good. So should we, when we start getting code snippets and code fragments and code full code things, should we have a Tangerine SDR tree on this website?
Well, yeah, we haven't started one, but yes, there is one, I think. If you look back, yep, it's there, but it's empty.
Oh, so John must have created it in Ackerman.
Yes.
So how are people able to post This is just GitHub, so anybody could post, right?
No, it's whoever's set up as the maintainers, and right now it doesn't look like they're. It's hard to tell. I can't see other than it's the three. So it's John, George, and Anna are the maintainers.
I'll be back in a minute.
Okay, so how did you find that out? I'm looking at the page now.
Well, the Tapper GitHub, the three maintainers are George, John, and Anna. And so I don't know who has right privileges to this. I'm trying to look at it. And I don't, it looks like they made the subdirectory, but they haven't populated.
Okay, but how do you know that they're the administrators? Know that, or it's on the online here?
Well, if you click on the Tapper site itself, it lists people, and people are the maintainer. And then in the directory, the maintainers can delegate permissions to write to other people. And the way, if somebody who is not a maintainer wants to send you code, they ask you, they make code on their GitHub, and then they send you a pull request.
Okay, so on the OpenHPSDR, they've added people like Phil and John and you and other people that can post?
Yes, and I'm a maintainer on those pieces that I work on, but not other ones.
Okay, good. So we can add people to, as far as the Tangerine SDR goes, we can add people as they need to be added.
Yeah, the idea is to have a couple people that can take care of it and not mess it up too much, and and then other people send pull requests. And that was what Tom was talking about the other night. Using it for a document can get complicated.
Okay, but a pull request basically just says, hey, I got something on my GitHub that you might want and needs to be up there. So you're administrator, so take care of it.
Yes. And then they have the maintainer has a right to either accept it and merge it or not accept it for some reason and ask you to fix it.
Okay, very good. I'm getting the hang of it. I'm a total Luddite when it GitHub stuff.
It's easier to keep a clean stream of stuff than SVN was. SVN, there were several ways you could break it inadvertently.
Yeah, okay. Good, because I kind of knew how SVN worked, but never. And we actually, if you look on SDR stick, we run an SVN server, allow people to pull stuff out of it. We don't allow anybody to post but us, but anybody can pull.
Yep, and there is a copy of the OpenHPSDR SVN on this Tapper website. That was the one thing that I did that kind of filled up a bunch of your space.
Is there a limit on how much space we have?
I don't know. You have a paid copy, so I don't know what that is. The free ones have some space limit.
But we probably have a 501c3 nonprofit version.
Yep. So anyway, the first thing to do is talk to George or John or Anna, whoever's the lead on the GitHub, and have ask them how do you want to deal with your Tangerine SDR. But they did make you a site, and it's listed.
I do remember asking for that, and then I think we had moved away from GitHub, so it onto our own directory that you're managing for documents.
Yeah, I think this is the place for code.
Yeah, I agree, and maybe. You know, specs once they're released and they've been coded.
Yes, and it's also a good place to put FPGA code as well.
Yeah, okay. Like I see OpenHPSDR firmware is like two down on the OpenHPSDR SVN is the one you were talking about, and then the firmware is the next one down.
Yep. The SVN one is there not because people are adding to it, but it's there for legacy and history of what was done in the past. Well, Scotty, what's that?
Dave has a raccoon threatening his wife upstairs.
He has a couple of cats go in and out, so maybe their food got the... I guess it's the raccoon's eating his bird food.
If you got a cat door, you might get a raccoon inside. Good luck, Dave.
I don't think he has a cat door. He has to let him in and out. At least that means he has to let the raccoon in.
Yeah, raccoons are pretty nasty.
They can be. And he lives with woods out his back door.
Okay, well, get me started on this. I'm still kind of working on the protocol for the RCC, so the LCC, and me and my business partner, in between doing paying work, we sit and brainstorm about how we can make the protocol work. So I'm going to write it up the way I think it should work, and then let everyone shoot holes in it and see if it's good, bad, or could be made better, or if I'm way off base.
Yeah, there was some, there was this work with some of the guys cleaning up all the different versions. So Joe Martin, several of the, and Phil and Rick. And Rick kind of took on this whole thing of running all of the versions through the same piece of code, but you know, some are on Cyclone 4s and some are on Cyclone 5. Well, I don't know if they have any on 5s, but it can get very complicated getting all together. So, you know, I would like to get the IQ2 kind of up to snuff with Protocol 2, and then that gives us a nice multifaceted platform set to work on for the new protocol. Or the tangerine protocol, I should call it.
Yeah, because the main thing I want is to be able to upgrade the firmware really easily, because it's, at the beginning anyway, there's going to be lots of upgrades, and I'd like people to be able to do it without having to download all of Quartus to be able to do it. You know?
Yes, that's usually an impediment, and the number of people that are proficient at Quartus are not a huge number.
Yeah, and you know, most people don't even want all that software on their computer. I mean, they're going to use it once to download, and after that they aren't. So I guess you're going to have to do it once, or you know, just send it back or get together with someone who has it to get the new bootloader in there. But then once it's in, after that it should be trivial.
So here's a story for 2 years ago. I was at Dayton. A guy had contacted me, met up with me, and he had a set of Metis boards that had the original code that you and Dan put in, and he had never updated it in about 10 years.
Oh my goodness.
So I went through all his boards and put a new copy of the most recent at that time code on each board, and he was amazed but had no idea what I was doing.
Wow, so you did that right at the booth at Hamvention?
Actually, I did it at the hotel. He was staying at the same hotel I was.
Okay, because I do remember at the Hamvention, I had a Byte Blaster with me. This is years ago, and somebody had brought in an HPSDR board, and that's back when John Ackerman was demonstrating his system, and I remember we just took his system down, plugged the board in, and hooked the Byte Blaster up and did a similar thing to what you were doing right in the booth.
Yeah. So there are people who buy these boards that don't really want to ever do that, and there are other people that love to experiment and try things. There are other people that will break things because they experiment too much.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? Okay. But so I hopefully when I get this protocol done, it's not going to look so heinously complex that it will be difficult to implement alongside Protocol 1 and 2.
Yeah, just take a look at those and see how they're done. And then if we can make them align fairly cleanly to those, then it should not be too hard to build a new version.
Well, the fantasy dream that I have is that this protocol could be used for way more different hardware than just Tangerine or HPSTR or any one particular radio. So the idea is to make it generic enough that there's only going to be one layer that's going to be radio specific, because at some point you have to know how many ADCs they are and how to connect them up to data streams and things like that. You got to know about the hardware. There's no way around it. But then the remaining pieces, like generating streams and doing discovery and things like that, they should be generic, and it shouldn't depend on any hardware resources to be able to do a discovery or to request a stream. But when you want to specify what's in the stream, now you got to know what hardware you're talking to.
Yes. And so it's kind of a combination of those two pieces. And we can segment the generic from the specific and maybe even make some pluggable protocols that fit in to tell it how to do it.
Yeah. So the main difference between what I want to propose and what Phil has done or Protocol 2 has done is that I don't want to use assigned ports. I want to use requested and granted ports. So the client will ask the server, what port do you want to listen on? And the server will come back and say, here's the port that I'm listening on, as opposed to just having the client tell the server, you will listen on this port. I don't want to do it that way. I think that's not safe.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. And as long as you know how to program that into the FPGA for the whatever's listening there, then we should be ready to go.
Scotty, that is sort of covered in the current protocol. You need one. You need to have at least one port that you know you're listening from to make the start. But the protocol actually allows you to set from the server all the other ports. So if you said I want a receiver on port, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then you can actually set that. The code's not implemented at the moment. When you set the board up, if the address defaults to 0, then it's the default port. But you can actually tell each of the microphone, control ports, the whole lot. You can actually, in the protocol, set whatever you...
Right, I saw that. I know you can set it, and there's a way to do that, but there's not really a way to ask the hardware what ports can I set it to. So you can just say, okay, I'm going to pick 1029, and that's going to be the one. I think that's the default. I'm going to pick 8000, and I'm going to use that one. But there's not really any way to ask the SDR hardware. Well, the SDR hardware we have control of, but the PC hardware we don't necessarily have control of. So I want to be able to query that and ask what ports are available, and then we can set it to that. So yeah, you can set it that way. I think what I'm thinking of is going to be a little bit different than that, and it will have to be implemented as opposed to just be a future plan.
Okay. Yep. Well, yep. That's that'll work. I say at the moment, once you've communicated with once on a fixed port, which will be unique to the IP address, you can then the server can set the hardware to whatever ports it decides. There is no way at the moment of saying, okay, here's a range of ports which are available, and because it's each board will have a separate IP address, basically all the ports are available. You probably send a range of a port, you can go from address X to Y and choose one from those.
Yeah, and the thing that is going to be a little different, I think, is which is going to give you problems in implementing this in the smaller FPGAs, is that we're going to use a NEOS to do this because it's going to be too hard to modify the state machine, use the new protocol, I think. I'm not sure, but I'm intuitively thinking it's the case, which means we're going to use a NEOS, which means that for the smaller FPGAs, you just won't be able to do it that way.
I mean, a NEOS process.
Right. It takes up too much resources. So like in the Cyclone 3, 3C15, I think, is the smallest one, or 3C25, you just may not have enough LEs to hit the NEOS. We're going to have the Mac will be a state machine, but it's going to be steered by the NEOS and run by it. So that NEOS processor requires some resources we might not have in all variants.
Okay, understood.
So that'll do is that'll just mean like... On a Hermes board, you just won't be able to get LCC protocol. You won't be able to do it because they're implementable.
Well, could it at that point fall back to a specific fixed address?
Well, you could just use protocol 2, which is implemented.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Yeah. And of course, you have a lot more resources and flexibility on the PC end. So the PC end, it's a lot easier to make it do protocol 1, 2, and 3 than it is to try and make the FPGA do that.
Yes, I agree.